This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When I discovered this, I was floored, and I realized that I really knew so little of what food was.
This week, along with the rest of the country, I'll be piling my plate high with abundant turkey, stuffing, cranberry sauce, and my grandmother's famous apple pie. It seems like a fitting time to reflect on food. Today on Sea Change Radio, we check in again with leading food journalist Frederick Kaufman to discuss the factors that go into fluctuating food prices around the world. He talks about the food commodities market, how our global food pricing system mirrors the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, and the potential impact of geopolitical and weather trends on the availability of food. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Frederick Kaufman. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He teaches at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He's written over 100 magazine articles and 4 books. His latest is Bet the Farm. Fred, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
I should say welcome back to Sea Change Radio. Last time you were on, you educated our listeners on wheat prices and how the food chain is completely skewed by the deregulation of our markets over the last several decades. And I recommend any listeners who want to re-educate themselves on that should go into the Sea Change Radio archives and check that out. So, but I want to move past some of that more complicated stuff on options and commodities trading and talk a little bit more about the food itself and what you focused on in Bet the Farm. Why don't you first walk us through some of the research you did on the theory of trying to feed the world with pizza and how Domino's and Tyson gave you some pretty interesting access.
Well, I thought I had a very simple question, which is why can't everybody on Earth have delicious, healthy, and inexpensive food? Because after all, we're making more than enough for everybody to eat. I think we're almost making about double the amount for everybody to eat. But in fact, the hunger numbers are still off the charts, and we're edging towards a billion. And so in order to start this investigation, I asked somewhat tongue-in-cheek, you know, why not take out pizza? After all, big industrial food is always promising us that they can feed the world, and we should not worry about those small farmers, 2 billion of which feed half the people on Earth. And so I said, well, you know, why don't I take you at your word? Why not feed the world with takeout pizza? And so I called Domino's. And I said I was interested in learning about the anatomy of a pepperoni pizza. And the next thing I knew, I was out in Michigan at one of their dough making factories.
And they ended up not being so pleased with some of the results that you found. But why was that?
No, they were. They ultimately, I think, they regretted ever letting me in. Look, I think that the subtitle of the book is "How Food Stopped Being Food." And what you see in pizza, I know we weren't going to go back in this commodities hobby horse of mine, but if you just think about a pizza, what you have is, once again, commodity flour mixed with commodity soy crush, better known as vegetable oil, topped with commodity milk made into commodity mozzarella cheese, with some commodity tomatoes and commodity beef and pork made into pepperoni on top. And so what does Domino's
sounds
do?
Delicious. Well, they're really,
yeah, it's great, right?
I just saw an ad actually for double bacon pizza. I was like, wow, that sounds really disgusting. But if they could just add commodity to that, commodity double bacon pizza, that's a seller right there. Sorry to interrupt. Go on.
buy it directly from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. That is so funny. So what is Domino's? Domino's is really kind of the retail arm of the commodity market. I mean, that's what occurred to me. And so the subtitle of the book is How Food Stopped Being Food. And so what I realized is a lot of these retail arms, the Domino's, not only the Little Caesars and Papa John's and Pizza Hut, but really all these great food retailers across the world and across America, they're actually not thinking about food as food anymore. They're thinking about food as an element in a spreadsheet, as an index, as part of their hedging strategy on these very large commodity exchanges, so that they're pricing. And ultimately, what my research for the book led me to was the big money behind food. I know there's been a lot written about the food industry and the food business, but I didn't feel as though as much had been written about the real money behind it as might be. And what I discovered, what I found behind the whole thing, is Wall Street money. And that was the ultimate way food has stopped being food, as food becomes one of those infamous financial derivatives.
So why is this a problem? I know that Bill Gates thinks that we should bring commodities markets to the developing world. Why would you disagree with Mr. Gates on why is this maybe a problem when you inject commodities markets into a food system?
The problem with Bill Gates and entering into global commodity markets and setting up global commodity markets is that it's become clear in the past 10 years that people perceive, and when I mean people, I mean people in the financial industry, perceive that food and fresh water and arable land is going to have increasing value as the years go on. And so they have figured out all these ways to allocate assets, hundreds of billions of dollars from sovereign wealth funds, from hedge funds, from pension funds, and they figured out ways to put them into food. And of course, what happens is that you then upset this incredible balance between the urban and the baker and the farmer that makes civilization possible, and you set food off into spirals of volatility and price hike. In the past 5 years, food has been the most expensive it's ever been in the world 3 times in the past 5 years, and that's because it's become an investment.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to food journalist Frederick Kaufman. You broke it down for us last time you were on the show really in detail on how food became an investment. With this reality in mind, let's now talk about how food strategy has worked in terms of geopolitics. I know that in the late 90s, the U.S. got rid of its national strategic grain reserve, but countries like India and China still have a strategic grain reserve. Why did the U.S. get rid of it? Was it because of deregulation, the deregulation mania that you speak of, or was there something else in play?
Yeah, I think the short answer is that there is a mania of deregulation throughout the 90s and this kind of great dogmatic belief in the power of global markets. Of course, what we saw is that as soon as the price of wheat and grain and soy and corn went through the roof, started going through the roof, all of a sudden that great dream of globalism kind of collapsed into a neo-nationalism. And we saw all sorts of countries out there setting up tariffs and export barriers, so which only worsened the global food situation. But yes, since the post-World War II era, food and food distribution, food aid have been essential elements of the perception of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, that is one of the reasons why, and one of the reasons why right now we are trying so hard to increase food inflation in Iran, because we know that the number one way towards regime change is food inflation. And we actually saw that playing out during the Arab Spring.
But it's not so simple, though, really, right? Because Iran has been running this oil for wheat program, which sounds great on the surface if you're worried about the people of Iran getting enough wheat. But that's not really what is at play here. This is a way for the Iranians to inject themselves into manipulating food prices instead of just straight oil prices. Is that right?
The Iranians have outsmarted us completely, outsmarted and outflanked us, because what they've started to do is trade their oil with Pakistan for wheat. And then since and hoarding that wheat in the great tradition of grain banking, you hoard the wheat, the price goes up, and then they are able to then release that grain on global markets and increase their supplies of cash and put their economy on an even better footing. So it really has backfired. But the dangerous zone of this we saw in Egypt, when the price of grain has tripled since 2002. We in the United States are beginning to feel that price signal. We're going to feel it more next year when meat prices go through the roof. And I think everybody sees that their quart of milk and their pound of hamburger meat has gone up. But we really haven't felt that price signal yet. We're still paying that 12 to 15% of our weekly paycheck. In Egypt, which is a traditional wheat-eating country and a traditional wheat-importing country, they were seeing 40% of their paycheck to food. They were seeing food inflation off the charts. And of course, this leads to regime change. And I don't know if we're particularly happy with the regime they have right now.
So if there's so many people that are starving, why are there so many obese people?
Well, this is the syndrome, Alex. And author Raj Patel out of the Berkeley area had a book called Stuffed and Starved, which kind of explains how these two elements go together. The price of food is near its all-time highs. Now, let's say you and I, let's say each of us, we have $5 a day to spend on our own food. That's it. I've got $5 to spend on my food for today. Well, I think the smart thing to do would be to go straight to the nearest McDonald's and buy two Big Macs and a supersized Coke, because I'm going to make sure that that $5 is going to give me all the calories I need. So, of course, what you're seeing is a choice like that towards a McDonald's or towards a high-calorie, high-sugar meal might actually be an intelligent choice when you're right on that line of do I have enough money to eat. By the same token, we're seeing another development across the developing world, which is that the number one sign of entering the middle class is meat consumption. And so although here in the United States, I think in certain circles, the perception of meat has gone down, and we understand the environmental hit of each bite of meat that we take, in other parts of the world, this seems to be very chic and an essential part of entering the middle class status. And so this meatification of the global diet is also working this syndrome.
Little man walked up and down. He found an eating place in town. He read the menu through and through to see what 15 cents could do. One meatball. One meatball he could afford, but one meatball.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to food journalist and author Frederick Kaufman. So if you were Tom Vilsack's successor, I think this is a good idea, actually. We should make Fred Kaufman Secretary of Agriculture. But if you were Secretary of Agriculture, how would you approach the grain hoarding that's going on, not only by countries like Iran and India and China, but also these large agribusiness interests like ADM and Cargill? How would you approach this from a U.S. perspective? Do you think it's better just to jump right in and try to rebuild a strategic grain reserve, or is there a better way to tackle this issue?
Well, first of all, I do have a candidate for next agriculture secretary, and that would be Professor Daryl Ray out of the University of Tennessee, who's a very progressive guy and was one of the first guys who actually argued to me for the necessity of a national strategic grain reserve. I think a national strategic grain reserve is a great idea. Nobody argues that we don't need a national strategic petroleum reserve. And the idea is really from the FDR era, and the idea is to stabilize grain prices. This is one of the things that one of the financial tools that helped bring us out of the Dust Bowl era. It helped prop up the price of wheat when it's too low, and it also, when the price of wheat starts spiking, it helped normalize it and stabilize it. During the Clinton administration, we had a farmer-owned grain reserve. So if you're anti the federal government, there's no need for the federal government to even be involved in this. We can do it just with the farmers. So that's one thing. The other thing is that there needs to be more international transparency in terms of how much grain other countries are holding. So, for instance, the Chinese will not disclose how much grain they are holding. This is being solved to a certain extent by the FAO, which is the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, who have new technologies coming into place for grain reporting and grain transparency. And this is one of the reasons why, even though we had drought in the United States Midwest and in Kazakhstan over this past summer, wheat prices didn't go up even more than they than they did, because we saw internationally signals that, in fact, there were pretty good wheat harvests in Brazil and some of the other parts of the world. Getting Cargill and ADM out of the business is going to be a much tougher thing to do. But one thing we can do is try to get the banks out of the food business. They were out of the business really from the 1936 Agricultural Act until 1999. And we just have to say, we have to bring back what are called position limits. In other words, you cannot take endless positions betting on the price of food. We've got to bring those back.
Speaking of the banks, Goldman Sachs President Gary Cohn, I heard you quote him say, there's no necessary long in grain. That kind of means that this is different. You can't go long in grain like you could in an IBM stock, because obviously grain can't last as long as something virtual like a stock. What does that mean when one of the more powerful bankers in the world is looking at grain in this short-term flipping mentality?
Well, Gary Cohn was, that was in congressional testimony that he gave a number of years back. And he really showed his cards much more than he wanted to at that point, because Goldman Sachs and a number of copycat banks, Barclays and Deutsche Bank and other banks in the United States, really have come up with, as I was saying before, these kind of Baroque financial instruments, which make it possible to take a very long-term stake, not in food, but in virtual food. In other words, let's say the Goldman Sachs and Standard & Poor's Commodity Index Fund. What you buy into is an index, a graph that goes up and up and up. And of course, when that graph goes up, you're happy. That's wonderful. My investment is accruing. What you're not realizing is that graph goes up and up and up. What you're seeing is the global price of food rising. And of course, this is the global number of hungry people are rising. Now, maybe you don't care about hungry people. I mean, that's an argument. Maybe people at Goldman Sachs, maybe it's simply, well, I don't care about a billion hungry people. Well, I think more and more since September 11th, 2001, we have to understand that we are not so immune from angry, hungry people outside the United States, that it's probably in our best interest on a certain level to think very globally about emerging middle class and making sure that those emerging middle classes are well fed.
And the real issue here is that this deregulation mania has, and the commodities index trading has really led to an environment where the markets really no longer mirror supply and demand.
Well, that's part of the big problem here, which is that commodity markets are actually can be wonderful things when they work very well, and they work well for price discovery and for risk management and for planning ahead. But of course, if they're perceived not to be tools to actually manage food or manage the commodities, but simply to manage money, they have been subverted. And so what became this very positive thing has now become a very dangerous thing, as it kind of spikes out of control and the volatility is now out of control. And so, for instance, in Europe, they're very focused on the momentum trading in commodities, because now in commodities we're seeing the same kind of activity as we see in equities, which is computer trading and momentum trading. And so the European Commission just came out with a law saying that in commodities, we're going to stop momentum trading. Every position that you take in commodities must be held for at least 1/10 of a second.
And that's one of the reasons why they're all fighting this hidden revenue that's coming from the exchanges renting out their spaces to these computers that are running their algorithms closer and closer to the actual exchange, so that they can trade in nanoseconds and beat the other computers by a few nanoseconds.
That's absolutely right. There's a huge hue and cry. How dare you say we have to hold a position for 1/10 of a second? You're stopping the market. We're not being able to arbitrage. It's not going to be a fair price. I mean, how absurd. It's kind of like the robots are running the world food supply. I think it's time to bring some sanity back to these markets. It's not as though we're putting a blanket of regulation on. We're just kind of going to what worked well throughout the 20th century.
Well, let's get back to the Dust Bowl, because we recently had Ken Burns on talking about his new film on PBS, The Dust Bowl. Where do you see some of the mistakes from the Dust Bowl rearing their ugly heads? We've had a wave of droughts, and climate change will undoubtedly mean that more and more of these droughts are going to occur. What kind of mistakes do you see us making again, and how can we try to rectify this, Fred?
Well, I think I'm going to answer the question in reverse, and let's say that the thing to rectify the climate change and the new difficulties in raising crops and the fact that we're seeing our yields kind of hitting a plateau, the way to deal with that is that's one of the roles of government. You know, government has to step in and to buy grain, to hold grain, to make sure that there's a reserve, to step in and to do everything they can to keep the price stable. Okay, those are all things government can do. Now, if you want to see where the big kind of the laboratory of the future, look to Africa. I'm heading to Ethiopia tomorrow to look at some agricultural, how shall I say, some farms in southwestern Ethiopia, agricultural development. But what you're seeing throughout a lot of Africa are water grabs and land grabs and governments kind of taking a step back and kowtowing to very large agribusiness and industrial business. Why are they doing this? Well, they want the money. They want access to credit markets. They want access to technology markets. They want access to commodity markets. Well, why shouldn't they have it? Well, of course they should have it, but they should not have it on the backs of selling their most precious resources, their arable land and their freshwater, to people who are simply going to export it in a neocolonialist fashion.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to food journalist and author Frederick Kaufman. A lot of people would say that one of the ways we've really evolved since the Dust Bowl era is now we have these great things called genetically modified organisms, and GMOs can help feed the world. But what's the problem with that?
Well, I spent a lot of time researching Bet the Farm in genetic modification laboratories across the country. I must have seen hundreds of genetically modified fruits and vegetables and grains just waiting there and not coming out. Now, there is a great promise that we hear from the scientists and from agribusiness that genetically modified crops will give us some sort of a grain killer app, that somehow we might have the waterless seed. In fact, to be completely fair, I did see a couple of grains and rices that could make a difference. There's a rice at University of California, Davis, which can be inundated by water for 2 weeks. In other words, it can withstand flood where other rices die.
So it doesn't get all moldy or anything.
Yeah, it can live. Now, this, I think, might actually be a great application. The problem is, when we think about genetically modified crops, we immediately think of Monsanto and Dow and Pioneer and Roundup Ready, and we think of all these terrible things that are really messing up the pesticide system and the environment system, and really being an assault on small farmers across the United States. We have to separate, I think, the bad playing of the Monsantos and the Dows from the possible, I'll say, innovations of genetic alteration that are happening in laboratories. I don't think it's ever been a smart idea to turn our back on science, and certainly Nigeria and China and India are going full speed ahead in this area of research. Even the scientists see that the monopolistic practices of large companies like Monsanto are standing in the way of possibly very good innovations. And so what I argue for is take the money stream that allows the monopolies of Monsanto to exist. And I think we can do it by changing some of the intellectual property laws associated with new genetic material. There's a Plant Patent Act that went into effect in 1930, and I think it's about time for some reform.
The thing that really kind of boils my blood is the hypocrisy of the agribusinesses, in that they want to say these are totally fine and they shouldn't have to be labeled. They're just normal food and you go about your business. But by the same token, they're collecting billions of dollars based on their patents of these seeds that have been modified to their specifications. So they're getting it both ways because they have enough money to perpetuate this myth that they're exactly the same. So are they exactly the same or not? Either way, they seem to win.
Alex, I think you've really put your finger on it. I really do, because I think that this whole labeling controversy, let's say that Proposition, instead of going down, had won. Well, sure, we'd have to figure out who's paying for this, how it's going to work, who's going to be lawsuits. But let's jump over that magically to a point where every Snickers bar has this little pink smiley face label saying, "Hi, I've got GMO, you know, high fructose corn syrup in me," and of course at that point, Monsanto and all those boys will just be laughing their asses off, because they will have realized that for years we've been fighting for something which is that little pink smiley label that says hi, and it won't make a difference. I am all for transparency. I am all for transparency, but I do not think it actually is going to have the desired effect, which is stopping the bad playing of the Monsantos of this world. One of the other reasons that labeling is difficult and transparency is difficult is something we were talking before we went on the air, which is that there's so little knowledge of what is in all our food. And so much of our food has been created using mutagenic processes, in other words, using either tumor-inducing carcinogenic drugs on germplasm or the seeds of plants, or hitting plant seeds with radiation so that they transform. These mutagenic crops are not considered genetically modified by the USDA or the FDA or anybody. And in fact, some of them are grown and produced and distributed under the organic label, if you can believe that. And so there's the very fact that there's this very specific kind of alteration using a genetic scissors and a genetic glue, that's the one thing that is singled out, that we're going to say we're going to be transparent about this. In some way, that's playing right into the food industry's hands, because they'll be able to say, okay, we've done it, we're transparent, go away.
So just to reiterate then, so seeds that have been created through these chemical or mutagenic processes can be sold under the organic label. Is that right, Fred?
Yeah, that's when I discovered this, I was floored. And I realized that I really knew so little of what food was. You know, I had kind of understood, oh, all apples are cloned. Sure, I got that. All our fruit is cloned. Okay. All this domestication and hybridization is this very long industrial process of 10,000 years. Sure, we created chickens. We created cows. I understood all of that on a certain level, but I did not understand the depth of how so many things that we're eating we've touched. We've touched with science. I just didn't see it. And that made me start to think that, well, is genetic alteration part of a continuum, or is it a break in that continuum of domestication over a 10,000-year period?
Author, food journalist, and Harper's contributing editor, Frederick Kaufman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by David Grisman, Josh White, and Weird Al Yankovic. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.